Hey everybody, this is Rish Outfield, this is the Rish Outcast, and this is going to be part two of Sleep Talking Gal. It's hopefully not been very long since part one, but last week I played it to the point where I wanted to stop, where I felt like there was the most dramatic tension. And now we're going to pick up from that point. I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and I've noticed that there are a couple of different ways, three different ways of doing audiobooks where, you know, they're on discs. And the first is when the space on the disc runs out, you just stop abruptly and the disc is over. And you better be paying attention, because at least in my car, it starts from the beginning, and I can listen to 30, 40 seconds before I realize, oh wait, you know, I've heard all this before. A second possibility is you end after a chapter. You know, a chapter has ended, so the timing might not be the same on every disc. You know, one disc might be 70 minutes, one disc is 65, one disc is 73, that kind of stuff, because you end on a chapter. And that's probably the best way, in my opinion, to end. And then the third option is, and some of them do this, is they go to a point and then music starts. And the music tells you, okay, this is when the disc is ending. You should grab the next disc or prepare to eject this. And the music plays, sort of fades out. And then on the next disc, the music is also playing, and you get a couple of sentences. You get about a paragraph from the last disc repeated to sort of remind you where you were. And as far as podcasting goes, you can do it any number of ways. But yeah, I think that's how I'll do this one, is that way with the music, with the fade out, and then you fade back in. I don't know. Like I said last week, not really sure how to do these things. It's just winging it. Self-taught, you know? Experience. But hopefully you're enjoying Sleep Talking Gal. You want to find out what happens next? Heck, let's find out together. Oh, special thanks, of course, to Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech. The guy rocks. And rolls, and jazzes, and world musics, whatever that is, and countries, and scars, and soundtracks.
And then, on Friday night, it all changed.
Eli,
she said. And before he could ask, yes, honey, she said,
you will remarry.
I will? He asked, more than a little taken aback.
A woman named Alex,
Diane intoned. Her eyes were closed, her face expressionless.
Short for Alexandria.
The words chilled him. She inhaled, pursed her lips, let out the breath, and mumbled,
not long now.
And that was all. Eli sat in bed for a long time, turning those words over and over again in his head. It was a strange one, wasn't it? Maybe more so than the other sleep predictions. Maybe about the same. But what he kept focusing on was, not long now. What did that mean? This time, he had no idea who she could be referring to. He didn't know anyone with that name. Never had. But more importantly, why would he possibly remarry? Why would he want to? He suspected the answer, and his mind went back to the week before. A nosebleed that lasted at least half an hour. Diane, with no energy, announcing she would call it a night at 8 o'clock. Complaints of a headache more and more often. And hadn't she looked tired? Haggard and old lately? Finally, He turned on the reading light and gently shook his wife awake. Diane. Diane, wake up. She asked, a combination of two phrases. Diane, how long have you been having nosebleeds?
I don't remember,
she said, and turned away from the light. Have you had a lot of them?
Sort of.
For how long?
Sometimes just for a minute, sometimes longer.
No, how long have you been having nosebleeds?
Just a couple weeks, she said. It's not a big deal.
And the headaches?
A little bit longer.
Not long now. Tomorrow we're going to make an appointment and get you checked out. She rolled back and faced him.
What? A doctor's appointment?
Diane didn't care for doctors. He didn't know why exactly, but nobody liked paying medical bills or filling out paperwork. I'm worried about you, he said. She started to say something argumentative, then stopped.
Okay,
she said. It's probably nothing, he lied. Because it wasn't nothing, was it? He wasn't exactly sure what the tests would show, but he had a general idea. He knew they would show something. Their family doctor was out of the country, and his replacement couldn't fit her in the next day, but they had an appointment for early the morning after that. Eli didn't get a lot of sleep the night she made her not long now prediction, so he slept through the Wonder Years alarm and missed what she might have said at 3:32. He awoke at 5:50, glancing at the clock. He cursed himself, sure that it would have been something important. His wife was ill, maybe even dying. He thought about it in silence. Were her headaches getting worse? Was it always on the same side or area of the head? There was blood on her pillow from another nosebleed she had slept through. On the drive to the clinic, he asked her, casually, if she remembered Marty at the post office. She claimed she didn't. When he reminded her of the office Christmas party, she vaguely remembered somebody dressed as Santa Claus, but didn't connect him with the name Marty. Marty himself had since come back to work, no worse for wear, and frankly embarrassed that everyone knew he had gotten his appendix out. "And how about Alexandra?" he asked, almost casually.
"At the post office?"
"At all. Do you know anybody with that name?"
"I don't think so. I think one of the Wilson twins is named Alex, but he's a boy."
"Ah," Eli said, not sure what he expected, but completely convinced she was telling the truth. He also asked her if she was a fan of General Hospital and how long it had been on the air.
"Oh, since I was a kid, at least," she responded. "Probably 20 years. Why?"
He had no answer. After a short appointment with the replacement doctor, they were referred to a specialist, a man named Kester. Dr. Kester wanted tests, as though money was no object, and they signed the forms. Eli would find a way to pay for it, if his insurance didn't come through on this.
"What do you call the man who graduates last in his class in medical school?"
Diane asked as they went to the elevator.
"What?"
He met her eye.
"Doctor,"
she replied, and laughed weakly. "I love you, Diane," Eli said, and surprised himself by crying. Just a little, no more than a good episode of an old, bittersweet TV show. They did x-rays. They did a CAT scan, and something called an MRI. When Dr. Kester, a child-faced man who looked too young for junior college, let alone medical school, asked if she had a family history of brain disorders or mental problems, Eli was surprised to hear that she did. That she'd had an aunt who died when Diane was just a little girl, of something that had grown in her brain. Diane didn't know what it was exactly, as she had called it a pull-up when she was a preschooler.
"A polyp?"
Dr. Kester asked.
"Probably," she said. "I don't even remember her."
"Could that be what she has, doctor?" Eli asked. His stomach was in knots,
and he kept hearing those awful three words again and again in his mind. Not long now. If so, the test will show us. From your symptoms, that sounds likely. Tears welled up in Diane's eyes. Headache? Both Eli and the doctor said at pretty much the same time.
My Aunt Gretchen? The one who died? Diane said. My mom said she was crazy in the end, saying things that didn't make sense. Scary things. She wouldn't even let us kids visit that year before she died.
This was the first Eli had heard about it. Suddenly, he wished she had told him this long ago, and more importantly, that he remembered her saying it.
Again, the tests will help us determine how severe it is, the doctor said, reassuringly.
He patted her hand, then withdrew it, a little too fast. For some reason, Eli didn't like him. He couldn't say why.
If there's anything there, he added.
Scary things? Eli asked her, fairly sure he knew what she was talking about, but needing to know.
What sorts of things?
Diane looked up from picking at her fingernail.
Scary what?
She seemed preoccupied, distracted, and rightfully so.
Your aunt? She said some scary things. I don't know. I never saw her that way, Diane said. Not that I remember.
The doctor looked at his watch. Eli hoped it was because he wanted the results as soon as possible, or that he had another appointment. Not lunch or a golf game or, judging from his face, a video game he was really into. Diane went on.
My sister said Gretchen turned into a witch at the end. I figured she said it to scare me, but Mom never corrected her.
I ought to go, Dr. Kester said. I'll let you get changed back into your clothes.
Thank you, Doctor,
Diane said. As soon as he was out the door, Eli grabbed his wife's hand.
What sorts of things did she say?
My sister?
Your aunt.
I think I blocked most of it out. I wanted to remember Aunt Gretchen as the sweet lady with the talking bird and the tins of those little wrapped candies, not sick and crazy. You know?
Sure, Eli said, thinking about himself in that situation. Only it was his wife instead of his aunt who got both sick and crazy. But what did your sister say? Diane rubbed her temple, but he didn't know if she was doing it because it hurt or because she was trying to remember.
Well, Kelly saw her once, the last time any of us except Mom went to visit. She said Aunt Gretchen got really smart before the end, knowing things before she died that she shouldn't know.
She shook her head. Apparently, it still scared her. Or maybe her own situation made her long-dead aunts all the scarier.
Like what?
He prompted.
Like secrets. But it was stupid, Eli. Just something my sister said to scare me. Kelly could be mean sometimes.
She sighed.
I'm glad Jean-Marie doesn't tease Joshua that way.
Eli nodded. Slowly. Now he was really scared. And that was odd, since he already knew there was something strange happening to his wife, and that she'd been feeling sick on and off lately. That the two were related made total sense, but it was kind of like knowing that Soylent Green was made from people, but still getting a slap of chilling realization when Chuck Heston discovered it. The tests had found a mass. Right there in vivid black and white. Some kind of growth on her brain. A tumor. Dr. Kester, child doctor, told them it was operable, but was the kind of mass that was better if caught early.
What's early?
Diane asked. Now is early, the doctor said, and assured them that things looked very positive. Eli didn't think his bedside manner was up to snuff, but he could feel the tension wash out of Diane in the exam room chair next to him. This is a textbook case, believe me, the doctor added. Diane hugged both her husband and the doctor. But Eli knew better. Sleep-talking gal had said so. They set Diane up with an appointment for immediate surgery, and Eli arranged a few days off from work. He realized later that his promotion evaluation had been scheduled for the day after her procedure, but he never even remembered it existed. He would have felt worse to have thought about it anyway. The time came for the surgery, and the last thing Diane Jacobs told him, before she was wheeled away and he had to remain behind, was that she had written him and the children letters. They were in a shoebox in the study, on the shelf with all the photo albums. Eli went to the bathroom 8 times while Diane was in surgery. The rest of the time he was pacing, talking on his cell phone, greeting and advising loved ones. He refused to sit down, let alone lie down, even though he agreed with his brother that it was irrational and stubborn. One time, in the many rides up and down the hospital elevator, Joe Cocker's "With a Little Help from My Friends" was playing. Well, the tail end of it anyway. And he stood in the corner of the lift and cried, relieved there was nobody in there with him that trip. The operation happened, the family worried, and while Eli wasn't much of a religious man, a lot of praying got done. And it didn't feel entirely strange. He'd had his eyes opened up to a world outside his own. Diane's sleep-talking had been a revelation, no pun intended, that there was such a thing as the unexplainable, the paranormal, from the great beyond. So why not invoke help from forces beyond this reality? And Eli was the man of the house, the father, the one who needed to be strong for the rest of his family. He did the best he could, letting his children lean on him, giving words of comfort to Diane's family as they visited or called on the telephone, saying optimistic things he did not believe. Not long now. That he could believe. But then, everything was all right once again. The nurse approached him with an expression of good news on her face, passing the relief on to Eli. Diane had come through the surgery with flying colors, and he could go in and see her. She was smiling when he came into the hospital room. Not a false, brave kind of smile, but a genuine, relieved smile. Diane was going to be fine. Butikofer, the family doctor, and the specialist, Dr. Kester, were both sure of it. The tumor was removed, safely and cleanly. They'd gotten it in time to avoid complications. They told Eli to bring her back, of course, if any symptoms returned. But that was, apparently, highly unlikely. Diane said she felt much better, and when, on the drive home, she called Eli Daddy, his shock was due to a silly joke.
"Sorry, honey,"
she said, leaning over and kissing his cheek.
"I couldn't help myself."
Eli took her home, and the kids waited on her hand and foot, and though she insisted she was better and it wasn't necessary, Eli could tell she enjoyed the attention. That night, they spoke for a few minutes before turning out the light.
"I keep thinking about my Aunt Gretchen," she said.
"That's understandable. Totally."
"All the time."
Eli told her not to worry, that they were out of the storm now. But he didn't know how convincing he was. He was waiting for the other shoe to drop, unwilling to completely relax. Diane shook her head, though that was uncomfortable for her. She was trying to force a jumble of erratic thoughts into a clear, sayable statement.
"They said I'd be all right, and I believe them."
Okay. He wasn't sure if he'd believe the kid doctor if he told them fire burned and water was wet. But Doc Butikofer, the man who'd delivered their son, backed him up, and that should have been enough.
"But Gretchen died," said Diane. "Of the same thing, you know? My aunt died just because she was born 30 years too early. The way medicine advances, the way knowledge changes everything. It's not fair that she had to die from something I don't."
"Fair," Eli said. But he thought he understood her meaning, and wished he hadn't.
"She was a nice lady, from what I remember. Just in the wrong time. If she could have just been..."
Honey, Eli said, wanting this conversation to end. Diane had a family that needed her. 100 reasons to feel grateful she was spared. 12 explanations, whether scientific or religious or coincidental or karmic.
I know, she said at last. I just can't help thinking about it.
He kissed her on the cheek. They shared a smile. Now, though, he found himself thinking about it, about what her aunt might have predicted, about how ill Diane might have gotten if he had failed to have her checked out and operated on in time. Should he tell her what happened? Would it make her feel better or worse? A few minutes later, Diane was asleep. Eli laid awake a while longer, worrying, wondering, pondering, but mostly just relieved he hadn't lost her after all. Instinctively, he awoke in the middle of the night, glancing over at the alarm clock, and wasn't too surprised to see that it was 3:31 a.m. He waited in the dark. A minute passed. He waited another minute. His wife didn't stir. At 3:36, Diane farted quietly next to him in the bed. Diane Jacobs' prophetic sleep-talking didn't come back. It took Eli a while to get used to her silence, and 4 more times woke up on his own just in time for her not to say a word. His investment opportunities, as few and far between as they had been, dried up, and Eli regretted that loss. But as cool and exciting as they had been, he thought that having his good wife alive was more important than any predictions about the future. On Monday, he went back to work with a spring in his step. Well, as close as you can get to skipping into the post office. There were always things to do in that busy building, and he was okay with that. Some of his bright mood was quelled when he found out that, once more, the position he wanted had been filled, this time by a new clerk. He groused about it to a coworker or two, but tried to put it out of his mind. It wasn't the end of the world. He, of all people, knew that. He did shoot the new clerk a nasty look when he saw her that afternoon, however. He wasn't above that. She was a pretty young thing, though, just the kind of girl he used to stare at in the park or moon over in geometry class. That made him like her even less, wondering if that face got her the job. She noticed him looking, and he quickly transformed his glare into a smile. She started walking in his direction, though he couldn't guess why. Hello, he forced himself to say. Above her small but pert bosom was a name tag. Alex. He blinked when he saw it.
Hi,
she said, putting her hand out.
I'm Alexandra. Nice to meet you.
So there is that. Sleep-talking gal. Well, you may know the backstory of this already. And I released an episode not too long ago, at the time of this recording, called Stop Me If You've Heard This One Before, wherein I started to worry about repeating myself, you know, saying the same things in stories. And certainly in the podcast, I worry about saying the same things. Telling the same stories, making the same jokes, and I wonder if that matters, if that's something that I should worry about. For example, when I was a young man, there was a radio station. Sorry, young man. When I was a kid, there was a radio station, and it was the hip station, the one with attitude that played new wave music, and we couldn't pick it up in the town where I lived because I was out in the middle of nowhere. But when I'd go to school, which was 15 miles away, you could pick it up. And my friends listened to it during the day and would talk about the DJs and their attitude and the fun things sort of games they would play and things that they would say, and they'd have these bumpers that were just adorable. I say adorable now, in the 21st century, but back then, they were avant-garde, they were cutting edge, they were irreverent. Wow, they really can do this on the radio kind of thing. And they inspired me. They were really, really cool. And then it went away around the time that I don't think I was even out of high school. Maybe it was the summer I graduated from high school, that station got bought out and turned into a country station or something like that. And these DJs, you know, they all had to scramble for work. And a few of them managed to put their money together, as far as I recall, and start a new station. But it was a risky venture for them. And so they had to play it safer. And some of the magic, not all of the magic, but some of the magic of that original station was gone. Eventually, that station split into more than one, and they started playing what was known as alternative, which I again, stop me if you've heard this one before. I really have a problem with the term alternative. Cut to 2017, and that one of those friends that used to listen to music in the 80s, 90s with me mentioned that there was a new radio station, and it was that. It was the guys from that radio station all those years ago getting back together and playing that music. And it's a small station, and radio stations are nothing now. You know what I mean? Back then, in the 70s, especially the 80s and the 90s, radio was such a big deal, such a big thing, because there was no alternative. Ooh, there's that word again. And now, here it is in the age of streaming on your phone and apps for that and a billion different satellite radio stations and apparently men walking on the moon. Radio is just not a big deal anymore. But these same people who are now have to be old. Sorry, guys, they have to be old. Have put together a radio station that plays new wave music from the 1980s and the first couple of years of the 90s, before grunge reared its ugly head. And these guys are delightful to listen to. And it's weird because my buddy Jeff, before he moved to Germany, I turned him on to this station, and he said, I will not listen to anything else. Nope. Oh, wow. He loved it as much as I did. And I won't listen to anything else either. I will just leave the station on that station, that channel, during the commercials, which I think they would be thrilled to hear. But in my entire life, I've never had a radio station as good as this radio station. And I could go on and on about how they play songs that I forgot existed. And I considered myself something of a connoisseur of music from the 1980s, once the MP3 was invented. But the trick was you had to know a song to go out and find it. And they play every single day a song I haven't heard since I was young, since I couldn't shave, since I was a little bit less pathetic than I am today. It's awesome. And I hear these radio DJs say the same things, make the same comments, make the same jokes. They play the same song sometimes and then make the same joke about it. And it doesn't bother me. It's familiar. It's comforting. It feels like getting together. It's like getting together with one of those buddies you had in high school. And you know they're just going to tell the same six stories together because you only had six or seven things ever happen to you in the short period of time that you knew one another. And when he tells it, you smile, you know exactly where it's going. But hey, here it is. If I repeat myself too much on the Rish Outcast, I would hope that you feel that way about me, where you're just like, uh-oh, here's Rish. He's going to talk about being a loser again. Here he goes. Oh, I hope he quotes Back to the Future. You know, is he going to do one of his three impressions? Oh, Rish. That would be nice if that was the attitude. Instead of, oh, guys, he's clearly limited. I mean, Johnny Carson, who does that impression anymore? And that brings us back to Sleep Talking Gal, brothers and sisters. Inspired, as you probably know, by Big Anklevich. He, more so than any of my friends, tells me things about his marriage, about his wife, about life on the inside. What's it like on the inside, Big? And it's hard to know whether he resents this or not, but sometimes he tells me something and I'm just blown away by it, and I've got to put it in a story. He told me about his wife becoming super obsessed with a treadmill, with walking on the treadmill, with, she went from zero to needing to do it all the time. He told a story about her not being impressed when they saw some lightning strike tree, I think it was. When I started writing the story about it, it was a weather vane or a church steeple or something that I changed it to. She was not impressed in the slightest. And he was just like, that's maybe the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. Holy cow, the power of nature. And she's like, eh. But something that he has told me time and time again, I just this week he told me another fun story about her. She is a really, really deep sleeper. And somehow, I can't do this, but she can wake up and have a conversation with him, and then go to sleep. And the conversation never happened, as far as she's concerned. And it's amusing when he tells it, but there have been times I know that it has been frustrating. When they've discussed this already, and you said this, and she said, no, I didn't. And he's like, no, honey, it was an hour ago, that kind of thing. Anyhow, the stories that he's told about her talking in her sleep and the funny things that she says, or, you know, the conversations that they have, and then he's like, oh, shoot. And she's like, what? You're asleep, aren't you? All this conversation we're having, you won't even remember that we had it. And she's like, I'm not asleep. And yeah, he's right. No memory. Anyway, he told me about this one time. It was a weekend when we were going to the family cabin, and it was in my head. I just kept thinking about it, and I thought about what kind of story you could make of a woman who talked in her sleep. And what I think I ended up doing was, it was one of those, wouldn't it be funny if stories. I thought, well, you know, what if she said things that are just weird or things that were nonsensical? And then she said something that was beyond weird, something that maybe meant something, said something that she couldn't possibly know. And I thought, hey, I've got a story here in this. And so what I did while I was at the cabin was I made a list, and I don't know if it was 20 things, 15 things, or only 10 things. Things that the sleep-talking gal could say. It was in the notebook, one of the notebooks that I write in. It was, so I don't have it in front of me. And when right before I left, I checked the work in progress document, which is different than the finished product document, because it'll have notes and it'll have little meanderings and things that didn't go anywhere. And, you know, sometimes I'll start writing a scene and I'm like, no, this sucks. And I'll cut that out for the finished product, but it's there in the main file. And I don't know why I'm telling you how writing works. You're probably a creative person. You probably know how writing works too. But the one that grabbed me, because there were different ideas, you know, like Kenny at work has a tumor. You know, so-and-so is going to win this football game. The Dow Jones is going to be up 18 points on Monday, you know, that kind of stuff. But the one that really grabbed me was, after I'm gone, you'll remarry. Not long now. And I remember that. The not long now was what put an exclamation point on the prediction, I guess. I think that that's what motivated me to make it into a story instead of just an idea for a potential story, which I have all the time. And so, yeah, I wrote it, and I think it was about 90% done. And then I forgot about it or abandoned it or didn't care. Or it's possible I thought that I did have it done. Because, yeah, I in 2014, I went into a store and they had the first season box set of The Wonder Years. And it wasn't really a box set because it was one of those shows that had like a 8-episode first season, maybe even 6. But I was just like, holy cow, really? Because The Wonder Years had been one of those shows that was super seminal for me as a kid, but was not available on home video because of music rights. They had a lot of popular 60s tunes, or early 70s tunes, I guess, after first season or two, that were not licensed for home release. And then because of these times they are a-changing, suddenly those music rights for those songs became insanely expensive. Stephen King, I was in an interview the other year, when he talked about that when he was coming up in the industry, in the right, you could just quote any song and the music publisher would be like, oh yeah, that's fine, as long as you say that it's us, as long as you acknowledge it. It's like a Creative Commons kind of thing. And then sometime in the late 80s or 90s, lawyers realized, well, we could charge a fee for all this stuff. Because like in the 80s, if you made a teen titty movie, the record companies would be falling over each other for you to use their music in your movie. So stuff like Fast Times at Ridgemont High or Last American Virgin or whatever, they didn't have to pay a dime for those songs. You know, IRS Records or MCA or whoever it was would be like, anything you guys want to use, that's great. Because they knew that they would get interest in their music. They'd be able to sell soundtracks, which were, you know, a big thing post-Grease, post-American Graffiti. And then one day, the lawyers, the music people said, whoa, why would we be giving this stuff for free? If they want to use All Along the Watchtower in their movie, then it's only fair we get $100,000 for that song. It's only fair. And so, just in the time that Stephen King has been a best-selling author, he's seen the shift from, you know, they fall all over themselves to be acknowledged in a book, to even King, who is a big star, can't afford, or, you know, Scribner can't afford to put all of these song quotes in his books. He's talked about, you know, there have been a couple times when he had to fight, and they said, no, they want $30,000 for you to quote this Rolling Stones song. And he's just like, and I guess there were a couple of times when he's like, no, it's kind of integral to the book. The lyrics come back again and again. That one, yes. I realize it's $35,000. We need to do it. But the rest of the time, he's just like, nope, sorry. Oh my gosh, I've been explaining music licensing rights for the last Bosk knows how long. I'm sorry. But suddenly The Wonder Years was available in 2014. And I didn't buy it. I don't know why I didn't. But what I did was I went straight home. And I got out Sleep Talking Gal, and he's like, this was in my era of self-publishing, and I said, I am going to publish this story, because it's a sign from the DVD gods that I needed to publish it. And I discovered to my horror that that there was a big section of the story that was unfinished, had become present tense and sort of a, you know, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then something happens, and eventually, and then the story picked up again. And there are many stories that are like that. Just yesterday, it was yesterday, kids, I was looking through an old notebook, and I found two pages from Like a Good Neighbor, a story that I self-published, I don't know, 2015, 2016, something like that. A story that aired on the Doonstief in 2017. And I was just like, holy cow, because when I was editing it for the Doonstief, I thought, well, this is weird. There's sort of a jump in the narrative right here. Huh. And so I went back to the file, the text file, because I thought I forgot to narrate like a chapter or a page or something like that. And no, it wasn't there. I was just like, oh, that was always my design, to have time just kind of jump like that. Weird. No, it wasn't. Here in this notebook that I saw yesterday, there were those, you know, the page and a half or 2 pages or whatever, that was all about Lara's relationship with her sister and the stepdad. The story works fine without it, if the story works fine. But it bugged the crap out of me because it was work that I did, and I had noticed that there was a gap. And there it was. That's the problem with the notebooks. You know, there's so many notebooks and so many stories that are in notebooks that unless I get the notebook and say I'm going to type this up, no one will ever read. So anyhow, cut back to 2014, Wonder Years DVD, Sleep Talking Gal. I said, okay, well, how much work is it going to be for me to finish this thing? Not much. So, you know, I fleshed out those 2 paragraphs. I mean, it probably made a difference of a page and a half or so. You know, the exact same amount that's missing from Like a Good Neighbor. Then I published it. And Big did the cover art for me, which is nice when he does it because he just has a better... He's just got more talent than me when it comes to making these covers not look crappy. I don't know. Maybe he just has more experience. But that's it. You know, I don't know if Big has ever even read Sleep Talking Gal. I talked to him just the other day about, does it bother you? Does it bother you when stuff your wife does or stuff you say ends up in a story? And I don't know what his opinion is. You know, people will tell you stuff in confidence and you probably shouldn't use it in your writing. But people will tell you stuff all the time that puts ideas in your head, things that you would never come up with on your own. And how can you not use that stuff? Even if you're a sci-fi writer or a fantasy writer, I think some of that stuff would still find its way into your writing. I don't know, or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I am limited in my imagination, and I need that sort of stuff. I need people to tell me what's going on in their married life, or tell me about their childhood in another country, or tell me about disasters that have happened to them, or really great things that happened to them, romances, times they got their hearts broken, times they broke somebody else's heart, times they were afraid. Lots of fodder for stories out there. And I wouldn't be surprised if Big's wife doesn't inspire at least one more story in the coming days. You never know what will inspire you. But it's good to be inspired. I hope you liked Sleep Talking Gal. I hope you like my voice and my podcast. If you do, I have a Patreon fund. You can support me. You get a couple things that nobody else gets. You get episodes early. And you get my thanks. Regardless, you get my thanks tonight. Thanks for listening. I've been Rashad Field. Sleep well.
The podcast you have just listened to was produced under a Creative Commons, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Share it while you still have the chance. The music in the show was by Kevin MacLeod over at incompetech.com. MacLeod, I am told, also has a license to kill. I must be dreaming.